Thanks for downloading our podcast. You can find out more about Tech Tent from our webpage. Go to bbc.com/programs/techtent. Hello and welcome to Tech Tent, your weekly status update on the technology business. I'm Rory Catalan-Jones, and with me from our online tech desk are Leo Kellyan.
Hi.
And Dave Lee.
Hi, Rory.
And also with us, our very special guest this week is the top tech entrepreneur, Catherine Parsons, who runs her own firm, Decoded. Hello, Catherine.
Hello, Rory.
She'll be giving us her insights on all the stories of the week. Now, first this week, web freedom in Russia. Is it evaporating as popular bloggers face a crackdown? Let's start with a reminder of what Vladimir Putin thinks about how the internet works. Here he is on the Russia Today channel talking about America's Patriot Act.
Everything you said about the Patriot Act and data collection is true, pure and simple, as they say. Everything goes through servers located in the US. Everything is monitored there. You should simply always bear in mind that such is the reality created by the Americans.
So, Mr. Putin thinks America runs the internet, and now Russia has brought in laws to tighten its own control. There'll be stricter rules on bloggers and measures that require social media users' data to be stored for up to 6 months. Critics say this is President Putin's way of increasing the state's control of online activity. The Kremlin, for its part, insists this isn't censorship. But what is being said on social media in Russia? Pavel Bandakov from our Russian service is here with me in the tent. Pavel, first of all, what do these new laws actually mean?
Hello. To say the truth, the new law is not really new because Russian legislation, it has some provisions to store data and to block the users on the web. For example, the leader of the Russian opposition, Alexei Navalny, is banned. His post on his live journal and Facebook is banned in Russia. So we can see it from the UK, but we cannot see it from Russia. And that is why everything is about the enforcement of the legislation. What is more important of what Mr. Putin said and what we've just heard is his idea that all the servers are in the United States, and that is why there is this new proposal to make it a law to store all DNS servers.
He wants to repatriate the web to Russia.
Within Russia, which is technically, close to impossible probably, but that's their idea.
And the other interesting line in recent weeks has been what's happened to Pavel Durov from Russia's equivalent of Facebook, VKontakte, the founder of it, sacked apparently. Tell us a bit more about that.
Well, Mr. Durov apparently left the country over the crisis around VKontakte, telling and quoting that the state is becoming really oppressive, that they demanded to disclose the personal data of the users of his network. And he told his advocate of the freedom, of the total freedom on the internet. And what he did, he left the country saying that it's impossible to work there and he's looking for a new home to start the business fresh, selling his share within in this social network business to other Russian companies.
So news there from Russia of what looks like a continuing battle between the forces of freedom and perhaps those who want to control the web. Thank you very much, Pavel Bandakov. Now let's have a look at some of the other highlights of the week. Our North America technology correspondent, Richard Taylor, he's beaming into the tent from Silicon Valley. Richard, hi there.
Hi.
That interminable Apple-Samsung patent battle may actually be coming to an end, is it?
Well, this particular episode, maybe, but it's, it feels already like a mammoth courtroom drama that's already dragged on for 3 years. The jury this time have been out for a few days. They may come to a decision today or it may drag on to next week. But at the heart of this particular battle is Apple looking for over $2 billion in damages from Samsung. They say that Samsung violated five of their patents, all concentrated around software this time. So they're saying things like slide to unlock and text autocomplete in nine Samsung handsets and one of its tablets.
I'm interrupting you because it's so dull, this battle, isn't it? Does it matter in the long term who wins this?
It may do. I mean, to be honest with you, neither company is coming out covered in glory. The reputation of both is being sullied. $2 billion, it's a chunk of change for a company like Samsung. They just made $8 billion in their quarterly profits. And to be honest with you, we're not going to get, even if it does come to that, to a $2 billion settlement now, it's going to be appeal after appeal after counter-appeal. We won't know for a few years yet exactly what the outcome would be.
It is symptomatic of an ongoing mega patent war, which is making a lot of money for lawyers, but a big debate about whether it's contributing to innovation. Thanks there, Richard. Now, I interrupted my preparations for this programme this morning by going off to meet one of the least known but most powerful men in technology, the founder and CEO of the Chinese telecoms giant Huawei, Mr. Ren Zhengfei. He spent 90 minutes talking to journalists. It was fascinating. He admitted that the mystery surrounding him had been a PR problem for Huawei, which, of course, has had big problems operating in the United States. He's a former Chinese army officer. He made it quite clear that Huawei had really given up in the short term trying to get into the US, but was very eager to praise the American spirit of openness. One really interesting thing he said was China could learn from America. He said Steve Jobs just couldn't have made it in China, and he seemed almost overeager to praise everything American while kind of accepting that he wasn't going to make it there. Would love to bring you a bit of a clip of that, but A, it was translated from the Chinese, and B, they didn't actually allow us to record it, but never mind. Leo Kellyan, you've got a huge potential clash opening up between Facebook and other mobile web advertisers.
That's right. Facebook announced this week the launch of its audience network. This is a way for it to place adverts within third-party apps. That could be a banner ad that pops up at the top of the ad of the app, or something more integrated, buttons, images, or text. The idea is Facebook knows all about the user's interest from all their activity on Facebook and all the things that they've liked, so it can deliver more targeted ads. And this is, as you say, a front against Google's AdMob, Apple's iAd, and a host of other companies that are in this area.
So, Catherine Parsons, our special guest, this is obviously a huge business, really quite an important development in this field. We're going to see everyone fighting over this growing mobile advertising arena, aren't we?
I think something like 60% of Facebook's revenues, ad revenues, actually come from mobile at the moment. So this is going to be kind of a huge leap for them. And it's quite incredible to think about the amount of data that they have about you. Where you live, Rory, whether you're whether you fancy an ice cream right now, and how can that data actually be used by third parties?
So I may be playing, apps. I don't know, Cut the Rope, some app that I may have signed into from Facebook, and up will pop an advert offering me an ice cream.
Absolutely. I think it's really important that the consumer feels aware and empowered about how their data is being used. And so that when they're served these adverts, that they know that information is actually coming from their Facebook.
We are giving an awful lot of data away. There's a fascinating story which drilled down into iPhone settings this week. I had a look and it showed everywhere I had been, the times I'd left home, the times I'd arrived at the office. If my boss saw it, he would have a complete timesheet for me. Are you aware personally of all that data you're giving to these companies and how much it's worth to them?
I think whatever service you are using now online, whether it be kind of Evernote or Dropbox or Facebook, it's very important to know that the information that you are giving away, that information is going to be used and owned by somebody else. I mean, those songs that you have on your iTunes, if you wanted to gift them to your children as a legacy, technically you can't really do that. They belong to Apple.
And briefly, Leo, I mean, mustn't underestimate how big a battlefield this is now between Facebook, Google, Apple, and so on.
No, it's a huge amount of money, but I guess the other thing that it does for Facebook is it stops them having to clutter their own newsfeed. But it's a balancing act, really.
Okay, moving on. Now, for most journalists like me, notes and notebooks used to be an essential part of everyday life. My desk was overrun with them. But in the brave new online world, most of my notes, and I suspect a lot of other people's, are stored in the cloud. Whole companies have developed to provide this kind of service. But how safe, coming back to that theme, is our user data stored this way? And what does the future hold? Will I one day be able to access my notes on a wearable device? I asked Phil Libin, chief executive of Evernote, one of the cloud-based notebook services, how I could be sure my data would remain available and safe from government snooping and from commercial interests.
We don't own any of your data. And we explicitly say we're one of the few companies that says that the data ownership does not change when you put things into Evernote. If you owned it to begin with, you continue to own it. And the second thing is that everything you put into Evernote is private by default. It's only yours. We never look at it ourselves. We don't data mine it so that we can sell you more ads. We don't sell it to partners. We're not a big data company. We, like every other company, have to comply with the laws of where we operate. We haven't actually had any interaction with any of the intelligence agencies, but that's no guarantee that it won't happen. We're very active, along with Apple and Google and Microsoft and the rest of the community, in urging and lobbying for much greater government transparency about what is the government actually looking at, what are they after. I'm a very big believer that this whole issue of government surveillance is a completely solvable problem. We just, as a society, need to get together and decide how do we want our governments to act, and then our governments will act that way.
I know you're interested in wearable technology. I've just noticed there's an app on Google Glass which allows me to save a note to Evernote. How do you see that developing?
I'm a really big believer in wearables in the future. The promise of wearables, I think of it as hyper-awareness. All of this technology eliminates the time of the day that I spent not knowing what I'm supposed to be doing or who I'm supposed to be talking to next. But in order for that to work, so many of the current ideas, so many of the current fundamental ideas in technology are going to break. So for example, what is the Evernote app going to be on Google Glass? Well, I don't think there's going to be an Evernote app. I don't think the idea of apps makes any sense on wearables. Our whole industry has to evolve away from the concept that you're going to be poking at your watch one screen at a time and selecting what app you're going to use. That doesn't make any sense. You're going to be interacting with your watch by glancing at it for 1 second. You don't have time to think about apps. Big concepts like files, like apps, will fade away. They'll be no longer relevant to be replaced with entirely new concepts. But maybe one way to think about it is apps that succeed in this world will have to mature. They'll have to evolve away from being apps and more to being services. And so what will happen with Evernote is Evernote will be a service that you subscribe to. But you subscribe to it in your life. You don't subscribe to Evernote as a service on your watch or on your phone. You just say, I just use Evernote. And now every device that you come in contact to, your glasses, your watch, your phone, your computer, your car, your refrigerator, your TV, all of these devices know that you're using Evernote and know what other devices you're interacting with. So if you glance at your smartwatch because you got a notification, and then you take out your phone knows that you just glanced at your smartwatch and it knows what you saw on it. And so as soon as you take out your phone, without you having to start any apps on the phone, it'll show you more information about whatever it is that you just glanced at the watch about, that kind of thing. Services in the future will have to be designed to cross multiple devices at the same time.
So that's Phil Libin of Evernote. I have to say, I have just used Google Glass to take a note and post it to Evernote, but I'm not quite sure why. Catherine Parsons, this whole wearable world with data flowing between them, does it speak to you? Are you into wearables?
Absolutely. The whole team at Decoded are very much into wearables. But what I love is it's about making you better at what you want to do, making your life better. So whether you're going for a run, Rory, or whether you're trying to do better journalism, it's about actually how you use this technology to enable that. It's very interesting because it's very personal. It's very much like personal data, how healthy you are, how fast you've been running. And I think that's when it gets quite interesting, because in the area of privacy and Evernote, your personal data.
Absolutely. Yes, I have to say I'm giving my running data to the world, and it's very, very frightening because it's so slow. You're listening to Tech Tent on the BBC World Service. I'm Rory Catlin-Jones. Now, have a listen to this. Sorry to deafen you all. That noise was from a YouTube video, one of many thousands whose origins and purpose are deeply mysterious. We're going to try and unravel this. Stephen Beckett from the BBC TV Click programme is here to tell us more. Stephen, what was all that about?
Well, it's a YouTube channel called WebDriver Torso that appeared about 8 months ago. And over the last 8 months, they've uploaded nearly 80,000 of these very strange videos. The format of the video is pretty similar across the lot. It starts with, you have a series of red and blue triangles combined with a musical tone. I'm not sure you can call it musical.
And have you worked out who's doing it and why?
There are a few theories floating around. Perhaps it's a competition to recruit the next generation of cybersecurity experts, a secret clandestine competition, or it could be a piece of automation software that's gone rogue, or indeed it could be a way to communicate with spies.
And what are you betting on personally? I mean, there's just been another one uploaded just today.
Today, after a 3-week silence, where drivers come out of hiding and has uploaded another classic video. I have to say, it follows a very similar format to the other 77,000. My bet is it's likely to be a piece of automation software, but I do enjoy the conspiracy theories around it. I'm very excited as to the potential for what it could be. Some of the ideas that people have suggested on the BBC News article, perhaps it could be a piece of conceptual art. Ed 80 said, looks like someone's trying to win the Turner Prize, has about as much artistic value as a light going on and off.
Well, all good theories, and you can add your theories on the BBC website. There's a great article by Stephen Beckett about that. Thanks, Stephen. Perhaps this next man is involved. Kim.com is, to say the least, a colourful figure. The multi-millionaire founder of the now-closed file-sharing site Mega Upload. He's accused by the US authorities of running a criminal enterprise and profiteering from piracy on a massive scale. The US Justice Department alleges that his website cost film studios and record companies $500 million. He's currently fighting extradition to face charges in the US. And our own tech reporter, Dave Lee, who's with us in the tent, travelled to New Zealand, where Kim.com now lives, to meet him. And Dave, what did you find?
Rory, I met Kim in the grounds of his huge, beautiful rolling mansion that he has just near Auckland. He lives there with his wife and kids. Back in 2012, in January, it was this house that was raided in the early hours of the morning. Around 70 officers and a couple of helicopters swooped down to take him away. 2 years later, right now, he's out on bail. He, of course, believes he's completely innocent, so much so that he's now in the process of setting up what he's called the Internet Party, which is a political party focusing on what Kim is calling Internet freedom.
The Internet Party was born out of this injustice. I was pulled out of my happy bubble and my life of creation and innovation. And, you know, I had all these ideas lined up and all these websites that we wanted to launch. So, you know, I mean, it woke me up to a whole new reality. And then you read an indictment and you're reading these things about yourself where you're just shaking your head like, who the hell wrote this? You know, it read like a Hollywood science fiction script. They got me completely wrong, they got my employees completely wrong, and then to allege that we are an international organized crime group, to basically compare us with a mafia organization, when all we have done was build websites and, you know, basically connect a giant hard drive to the internet that everyone could use without any criminal energy behind it. You know, you just shake your head and you go, there's something seriously wrong.
So here's an overweight German computer geek with a lot of bling fighting a legal case saying he can get into politics. What do New Zealanders think of it?
Well, Roy, New Zealanders are generally quite matter-of-fact people. They don't like to, muck around. But so I was expecting to find a lot of resistance to Kim and his ambitions. But over my time there, I found a lot of people came up to him to offer his support as we were driving through. They'd cheer him on. I asked Kim why he thinks this was, and his theory is that the NSA revelations have made people care a lot more about what was happening to the internet. Here's what he had to say about Edward Snowden.
Well, to me personally, he is a hero. His sacrifice will be remembered as one of the most heroic things of our time. You know, right now you still have a lot of people that are hurting inside governments that call him traitors, right? But I can tell you for sure in a decade from now, people will be inviting him as keynote speakers. He's going to win 100 awards. They will build statues for this guy because what he has done single-handedly, he has opened the eyes of the world to an injustice. And because we know about it, we can do something about it.
That all sounds very worthy, Dave, but a lot of people think Kim's a criminal, a person who encouraged people into piracy, and he certainly leads this extraordinary life. I think he was arrested with $1 million in cash on him. There are guns, there are Cadillacs, whatever. Is there a bit of PR around him that people are being conned by.
Indeed. Well, as a 6'7" man who's quite big, as you say, he's not really subtle, is he? And his house and his cars and all the flashiness that comes with it doesn't really kind of keep him in the background. And indeed, in the time it took me to fly from London to New Zealand, yet another lawsuit had landed at his desk, and this time from the record labels. In July, we'll find out if he's going to be extradited to the US to face the charges. I asked him if this worried him.
Well, it's never going to happen. You know, I think the extradition will fail because copyright is not an extraditable offense in New Zealand. They chopped on these extra charges, you know, using the transnational organized crime treaty to basically sell the court a story here that we are the mafia. And that's not going to fly. There's no evidence to support that at all. So they're going to lose.
So Kim.com, and you can see a film of Dave's time with him on BBC Click tomorrow. Now, before we go, it's a topic that's become a hot talking point in the world of technology recently. Is Silicon Valley sexist? Do women struggle to get on? And how do we encourage more women to code their way to the top? Next week, we'll have an interview with the computer programmer and author of a fascinating book on geek culture, Vikram Chandra. He told me the current machismo around computer programming, especially in the US, seemed at odds with the history of the discipline.
There's nothing about programming and computer technology that makes it essentially male. And if we look back at history, we can see this, right? Ada Byron and Grace Hopper and a host of others were pioneers in the field before it sort of got converted or set in the culture as this male idiom.
Vikram Chandra there on the macho culture of programming in Silicon Valley. Catherine Parsons, who's immersed in the world of coding, is the US experience typical in London and other places, or are women actually making an impact now?
I was very surprised originally because about the statistics about women opting into technology, STEM at a young age, and opting out of technology during their careers. It's something that I've talked a lot about as being almost looking like a female future dystopia in the UK. These are some of the most sought after jobs, careers, gives you incredible freedom. And yet the amount of women actually embracing technology as something for them is worryingly low. And I agree, it's myths, it's cliches, and we need to get rid of
that. Something about the culture, though, isn't it, of you know, you have to be somebody who stays up all night eating pizza and, you know, being incredibly butch to code, which is kind of nonsense.
Yeah, the bro grammar, the fact that, you know, the only loo at a tech conference with no queue is the women's loos, and, you know, all of that. And, you know, that has definitely emerged. Where there's smoke, there is fire. But what makes me feel positive about it, unlike the vote, which, you know, legally we weren't allowed to opt into, this is about getting rid of myths and cliches, and that's a much easier thing to do. So the more women that opt into it, the better.
Catherine Parsons doing great work in getting rid of some of those myths in her work in encouraging people to get coding. I'm afraid that's all we've got time for this week. Thanks very much to Catherine and to Leo Kellyan and Dave Lee. Don't forget, all the stories you've heard about this week are there in more detail on the BBC News site at bbc.com/technology. Tweet us at BBC Tech Tent, and please join us again next week.